ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, childcare workers to be listed on a new national registry as the country's education ministers agree on a raft of new safety measures. Also, a French company set to become the biggest producer of dairy products in Australia, and the world's toughest horse race on the wild plains of Mongolia.
Over 20 k's into a leg, it just dropped its bum down and just shot forward and flicked me off the front. And I tried to hold onto the rope so bad, and it dragged me, and I've still got like cuts on my fingers, and we never caught it, and I ended up losing all my gear. And this was like 3 days till the end of the race.
After shocking revelations of abuse in childcare centres, the nation's education ministers have today agreed to introduce some major changes to the way the sector operates. The reforms include rolling out CCTV cameras in hundreds of facilities, mandatory child safety training for all educators, and the first ever national register of childcare workers. The plans are being welcomed by the federal opposition, but child safety campaigners say improving workforce standards and boosting staffing levels are crucial if children are to be kept safe. Alison Shaw reports.
It's being heralded as landmark reform.
We've agreed on, by working together, the strongest and most significant package of child safety reforms in our nation's history.
Federal Early Childhood Education Minister Jess Walsh says there's consensus among states and territories that more action is needed to keep children safe in childcare. That includes the first ever nationwide register of early childhood educators. It will include their contact details and work history, no matter where they worked in Australia. Federal Education Minister Jason Clare says the register will also include information that regulators have about workers, including who's prohibited and who's under investigation. It will also detail the status of their Working with Children check.
We think that as we develop and build this register over time, it's an opportunity to build that type of skills passport or that qualification index that tells us more information about individuals in our centres.
But he says putting the register in place will take time, with a trial in December and the system rolling out next February. Also announced today is mandatory safety training for all educators. Jason Clare says it will help workers spot bad behaviour and encourage them to report it.
The most important thing we can do is skill up the workforce to be able to identify somebody who is hiding in plain sight, not just grooming kids, but grooming them.
Sam Page is the CEO of Early Childhood Australia, the nation's peak body representing the sector. She agrees the training will be critical.
It's other educators being experienced and competent and alert to red flags and not allowing children to be isolated or taken away from the group, or for educators to be alone with children. That's what's going to keep children safe.
In the next few months, a trial of CCTV cameras will also be rolled out in 300 facilities across the country. Sam Page says many in the industry initially feared introducing cameras was a knee-jerk reaction, but now the plan is widely supported.
It can be useful if there is an incident or an accusation between two members of staff, for example. The CCTV footage can help resolve that, can help with reviews of what has actually occurred and provide evidence in cases where action needs to be taken.
But not everyone agrees. Talkback caller Eve says she's been an early childhood educator for nearly three decades. She believes CCTV is a distraction from reforms to staffing levels and ratios.
I feel like it's very cumbersome and very reactive. This is a quick fix, easy, probably less expensive solution. It's very important to have the right child to staff ratio. If you have two staff with children all the time, there should not be an issue. If there's always two sets of eyes within the room, then there's always that accountability.
Advocates say the introduction of CCTV cameras will need to be done carefully. Catherine Little is the CEO of SNAKE, the National Voice for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children.
These things need to be approached with a level of caution because there is no such thing as a panacea. Some of the things that the government is going to need to keep on its radar is how will you monitor it effectively? Are those systems hackable? In this day and age, it's really easy for those sorts of monitoring systems to be hacked and used in a way that is not good. And does it give a false sense of security for families when what we really know we really desperately need is an incredible investment into the workforce and infrastructure that supports children?
Catherine Little says structural reform will be more effective to ensure standards across the sector are lifted when it comes to hiring early childhood educators.
You've got to change it by looking at the systems and structures. One of those is the current funding model. It currently weights itself to for-profit. And again, when we're looking at the care of children, for-profit shouldn't be your ultimate gain. But at the heart of them comes down to the investment into the services themselves and the investment into the workforce that makes a workforce the one that you need to ensure that your children are safe and protected.
Centres will also be required to have a policy in place from next month banning mobile phones while working with children. The federal government also says more information will be made available to parents soon about the performance of childcare centres. That'll include when the regulator has last inspected a facility and whether it's breached national standards.
Alison Chow. The New Zealand dairy giant Fonterra is pulling out of Australia and planning to sell all its brands to the French company Lactalis. Those brands include Perfect Italiano Cheese, Western Star Butter and Mainland Cheese. The sale still needs approval from the Foreign Investment Review Board, but if it goes ahead, Lactalis would be by far the biggest dairy processor in Australia, and farmers are worried that would give the French company too much market power. Luke Radford reports.
Every time you pour a glass of milk, crack into some yogurt, or rip open a bag of cheese, the milk that went into it has almost certainly been through one of Australia's dairy processing companies. One of the largest is Fonterra, a New Zealand-based cooperative. Renee Dodonka is Fonterra's Managing Director of Global Consumer Business.
Look, it is a big day for dairy. Today, the Fonterra Cooperative has announced that it has agreed to the sale of its global consumer business, which includes Oceania, Australia and Sri Lanka, to Lactalis for $3.845 billion, so just over $3.8 billion NZD, so NZ dollars.
Fonterra's decision to sell its global business is a seismic shift in the Australian dairy industry. Lactalis, which is French-owned, is already the largest dairy company in the world. This purchase would also make it the largest dairy company in Australia, and it has the tick of approval from the consumer watchdog, the ACCC.
The ACCC said very clearly that Lactalis and Fonterra both currently acquire raw milk in Australia, so there was an investigation, if you like, or a review. And the outcome of that is that there's limited overlap and that the acquisition is unlikely to result in a substantial lessening of competition for raw milk. So the ACCC, as a regulator, have approved it.
But not everyone agrees. President of the United Dairy Farmers of Victoria, Bernie Free, is concerned that they could rationalise operations and close some factories.
You're going to spend that sort of money. You've got to look seriously at all of those costs. It means that there's the possibility of some factories closing, which is not good for the local community or the dairy farmers in that area. You know, we need a strong dairying industry and we need strong players and we need competition.
The national advocacy group Australian Dairy Farmers is also concerned about the sale. It put a submission to the ACCC arguing that the sale would threaten competition in Australia, which was ultimately rejected. Ben Bennett is the group's president.
We're now going to have, as it looks like going forward, three companies controlling 70% of the raw milk. But not only that, they control the peak processing capacity of the industry. So all the little companies that sort of rely on milk, say more like Monday to Friday, they've got to put that surplus somewhere else.
Meanwhile, the farmers who actually sell milk to Fonterra will be watching on anxiously. Paul Weller is the chair of the Fonterra Suppliers Council, which represents the farmers who supply milk to Fonterra.
Any contracts that are there will be honoured. That's been made quite clear, and that was one of our things all the way through. The contracts will be honoured to give farmers certainty, and that's been clear for the last 12, 18 months that that would be part of it. If lactars, or the, when they buy it, want to continue to have the same level of supply, they'll need to continue to have a good relationship with their suppliers.
Lactalis has not responded to the ABC's requests for an interview, but in a statement says it's delighted to become a key partner to Fonterra over the long term and looks forward to welcoming new teams to the Lactalis family. So at the end of the day, what does the sale mean for consumers? Fonterra owns Perfect Italiano cheese, Western Star butter and Mainland cheese, all of which will become Lactalis brands if the sale goes through. Michael Harvey is a senior analyst at Rabobank.
In reality, it shouldn't mean too much, both, you know, for farm suppliers or for consumers. Yes, you know, assets are changing ownership and brands are moving around, but at the end of the day, the brands will still be on the supermarket shelf. They'll still need milk to produce those brands. So behind the scenes, there shouldn't be too much disruption, but there's always a little bit of uncertainty around, you know, what's going on behind the scenes as you see these sorts of events occur. But at the end of the day, they're acquiring the assets to run them as normal moving forward.
The sale still requires several more steps before it goes ahead, including approval by the Foreign Investment Review Board in Australia.
The report from Luke Radford and Warwick Long. The maker of some popular sunscreens has been forced to apologise to its customers after discovering one of its products wasn't delivering the sun protection factor, or SPF, that it claimed. The brand Ultraviolet has now announced it's withdrawing the product from sale. The company's admission comes after testing earlier this year by the consumer group Choice revealed some sunscreens were failing to live up to their promises. Isabel Masali has more.
It was a chat with a neighbour that inspired Tricia Jarvis to switch sunscreen brands.
She's got magnificent skin, and I asked her what sunblock she was using, and I was actually at her home and she brought it out and I tried it on my hand and I thought, oh, this feels more like a moisturiser than a heavy sunblock.
Some types of sunscreen irritate her eyes. When this one didn't, she bought boxes of the Ultraviolet product. Her GP also had it on display at her practice. So they were both struck by a damning report from consumer group Choice, which found the brand's lean screen wasn't SPF 50+, like it claimed.
I said, what's your take on it? And she went, I'm just finding it a bit hard to swallow.
Choice tested a range of sunscreens and said the Lean Screen SPF mattifying zinc sunscreen returned an SPF result of just 4. The June findings sparked a war of words between the consumer group and the company, which strongly defended its testing. But today, Ultraviolet has announced it's voluntarily pulling the product after failing further tests.
I'm really, really disappointed because it is an Australian company and I thought that they had done all their studies. I feel that they've really hoodwinked the consumer.
In a statement, Ultraviolet said across 8 different tests, Lean Screen returned results ranging from an SPF of 4 to 64. They said this wasn't good enough for us and it isn't good enough for you, and is offering refunds. They went on to say it's no longer working with the original testing lab, then stressed the issue doesn't affect other products. Choice CEO Ashley De Silva.
I mean, we first notified Ultraviolet of this in March, so it's now August that they're arriving to that same conclusion. So I think it's absolutely the thing that any brand of any product that doesn't believe that it can be confident that it's meeting its claims needs to stop selling it. And in a category like sunscreen, where people rely on it to protect them from, you know, the harmful effects of the sun, it's even more important. And so I think it's the right thing to be pulling it from shelves today and to be letting consumers know that they're eligible for a refund if they had bought it the product this year.
John Staton is one of Australia's leading experts in sunscreen testing.
Well, I think essentially you really should make sure that you revalidate your products and your test laboratory at reasonable intervals to ensure there's no conflicts happening. I think you have to take this particular example in isolation because we have a serious difference between SPF 4 at one end and I think the other up in the low 60s. That to me doesn't make any sense at all.
Dr. Jessica Stokes Parrish has welcomed today's announcement that the sunscreen will be pulled from shelves. She's an assistant professor of medicine at Bond University.
I don't think this is a bad thing. I think it's good that they're being transparent, they're being proactive. I mean, the community was pretty vocal about their dissatisfaction about the report. So from my view, I kind of interpret it as being a positive response from them.
Professor Stokes Parrish is urging customers to think twice about their sunscreen choice.
Look, I think we should be careful of where we're purchasing our sunscreen from. If large manufacturers can find issues with their product, then we should be even more skeptical of backyard sunscreens that are being marketed on social media and, you know, some of the smaller companies that don't have the same level of testing or scrutiny.
But she says her big message is Australians don't apply enough sunscreen and should remember to wear a hat, cover up and avoid the heat of the day.
Isabel Massali reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Well, in the last few weeks, we've had a couple of stories for you on the problems Australian writers, actors and musicians have been having when their works are used to train artificial intelligence or generate AI material. Essentially, big tech companies aren't notifying those creators that their work is being used, nor are they paying for it. But today, the union, the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, has announced a breakthrough. The peak body for the nation's big tech companies, the Tech Council of Australia, has agreed to negotiations on AI matters next month. For more on this development, I spoke to Adam Portelli, the Deputy Chief Executive of the union, the MEAA, and I asked him to give us an example of the problems union members are facing.
We've got a couple of voice actors that have recently been sacked after working a season of a particular program, only to be replaced the very next season with voices trained through an AI bot by their own voices. We've had the case of a journalist, an AI-generated presenter in Sydney just recently. There are platforms right now that generate songs that mimic the voices of well-known Australian and international singers. These are just a few examples of creative and media workers who are having their art, their music, their words stolen. They're being used to train AI models and they're being taken without any consent or compensation.
So the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance is now pleased that the big tech companies are prepared to sit down and discuss this and engage in negotiations. Which tech companies are we talking about and what's been their argument in terms of why payment isn't required?
Well, it appears to be that the Tech Council at this stage, the umbrella group representing the various big tech organisations, it's very much a positive development. But I think it's also very early days. So I imagine there will be a number of steps on the road before we get to anywhere where we can see concrete developments.
What's been their argument, though, that payment isn't required?
Well, that's been unclear. It's certainly welcome that in the last 24 hours or so that they have acknowledged that media and creative workers deserve to be paid. So they recognise there's a problem. It's unclear what their position was in the past. There is really no way around acknowledging, firstly, that there is a copyright system in place, and our position on that remains the same. It should be maintained, and that creative workers deserve to be paid for the work that they perform.
And in those negotiations, what are some of the things the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance will be calling for, aside from payment?
There are things like labelling that we're still seeking so that consumers know what is being made by humans, what isn't. Transparency. We think it's only fair that the data used to train AI is available, you know, publicly available, which would make it easier for copyright holders to enforce. And we think it's only reasonable that there is some way for the big tech companies to pay creative and media workers. How that looks, the mechanism, I think, is going to be there to be discussed in the coming weeks and months.
So you're wanting to see people like voice actors, actors, writers, I suppose, notified that their work has been used to either train or create AI-generated content?
Well, creative workers need to have agency, there needs to be both consent and compensation. And for the public needs to know when they are consuming art, when they are consuming music, literature, whether or not that is human-made or whether that's come from AI. That's really important.
The peak union body, the ACTU, was represented at the Treasurer's Economic Reform Roundtable this week. What are the unions calling for in terms of AI legislation, and what was the feedback you got back in terms of how well those conversations at the roundtable went?
Well, unions, including ours, continue to advance the case for an economy-wide AI Act. That's been our position, that's been the ACTU's position, and continues to be the position of unions. That hasn't changed, and it remains to be seen how the government is going to react to that call. We're still making representations to the government that that is the best way to tackle what is an economy-wide problem.
Adam Portelli is the Deputy Chief Executive of the union, the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance. And the Tech Council of Australia has released a statement saying, quote, it's looking forward to working through what AI means for different sectors, including opt-out models, and that it's hopeful a path can be found on copyright that allows AI training to take place in Australia, while also including appropriate protections for creators who make a living from their work. And the Tech Council is looking forward to collaborating with the unions and the government. Well, the Mongol Derby is often described as the world's longest and toughest horse race. The 1,000-kilometre trek across rugged mountainous terrain in Mongolia sees the horses swapped out every 35 kilometres, and fewer than half of the human participants finish the course each year. This year, one of the teams that made it was a married couple from Western Australia. Amelia Searson prepared this report.
For most of us, horse riding is certainly not easy.
Pick a fast one!
But it's an even greater challenge when the horses are only semi-tame. Throw in a 1,000-kilometre track through mountains, valleys and plains of Mongolia, and you've got what's known as the world's toughest horse race.
It was as hard as I thought and a bit harder.
That's Lucy Fiori, a professional jockey from Western Australia.
I've ridden since I could walk. Mum and Dad trained racehorses my whole life. I always did some show jumping with Mum. When I turned 16, I was like, how can I get out of school? And so I started an apprenticeship as a jockey.
Lucy has the sort of experience you would expect from a rider taking on such a grueling race. But her husband, Brandon, hasn't been honing his craft quite as long.
I've only really seriously been riding for about 3 years.
Brandon Fiori was working in construction when he met his future wife, Lucy, at a pub in Western Australia. 6 years later, and the pair have finished the Mongol Derby in third place.
A few people from home have done it, and I'd always kind of put it on my bucket list. And then we'd gone away last year. I don't know, we just got talking about bucket lists and I said about it, and then Brandon was like, hell yeah, I'll do it with you.
The Mongol Derby attracts adventure-seeking riders from across the world, but less than half of the competitors end up finishing the race. And that's not surprising. Competitors must change horses every 35 kilometres, and those horses are only semi-tame to begin with. As Lucy Fiori explains, riders have to battle the elements as well as their own physical and mental health.
The pain, like, just, I don't know, like, you chafe, gets so bad on your legs, and it doesn't matter what you put on it, that you just chafe. And my knees were really sore, which, again, like, I had prepared for, but then, like, in the moment, just, I don't know, it just took over me, and I just said to Brandon, I'm like, I'm really sorry, I just need to have a cry and then I'll be okay.
We're 20 k's into a leg, so it was a 30 k leg. We're 20 k's in, sort of let my guard down a bit, and we're just trotting over a hill, and it just dropped its bum down and just shot forward. Now it caught me off balance, and then just stopped and whipped to the right and flicked me off the front. And I tried to hold onto the rope so bad, and it dragged me, and I've still got like cuts on my fingers and stuff from it. We never caught it, and I ended up losing all my gear. And this was like 3 days till the end of the race, so I had no sleeping bag, no clothes.
The couple agreed it was the longest and toughest horse race in the world, But it was also the ultimate relationship test.
Yes. Yep, definitely. It's a test of many things.
What an event. That's Lucy Fiore, a competitor in the Mongol Derby. That report from Amelia Searson. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Joram Toth, David Sargent and Nick Dracoulis. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back on Monday evening. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu says Anthony Albanese is a weak leader who's betrayed Israel. But do we really need to be in lockstep with Israel as it broadens its assault on Gaza? Today, Global Affairs editor Laura Tingle on the dramatic slide in relations. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.